There is something happening here, but at the end of this long Democratic primary race, what it is ain't exactly clear. This is the last day of the primaries, and Hillary Clinton has a big speech planned for this evening. And if this is the time when she begins her concession to Barack Obama, then something will be happening here. Aside from the fact that an African-American will be the candidate for a major party for the first time, Obama promises to bring a throng of younger voters into this campaign, and he would hope, into the election. So who are these younger voters, and what kind of commitment do they really bring to politics? What I often do here on The Story is turn a half page back in history to see what lessons are already there. So what I'm doing today on the program is looking at the story of one young man who came of age in the last election. Andy Shapiro was one of the so-called Dini babies, or Diniacs, who threw his gear in a car and headed for Iowa to help Howard Dean become president.
All of a sudden, there are these caravans of just cars with Dean stickers and Dean posters and Dean billboards and everything, and people waving at every other car and honking, and it was just this convoy of people from all over the country coming from the East Coast and coming from Ohio and everywhere, flooding in, and everybody was our age, and it was an incredible sight. I think it was probably the strongest communal group I've ever been a part of, even if lots of those relationships that formed weren't that deep, and I don't really keep in touch with those people all that much anymore. It was still one of the strongest communal bonds I have ever had in my life.
The passion for politics and what comes after. We'll hear what drew Andy Shapiro in and where he is today. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Generation Y, the youth vote. Young Americans under 30 will make up a quarter of the electorate in this year's election. And the leading Democrat, Barack Obama, has the edge in support among those younger voters. This time around, Andy Shapiro is watching it all unfold from the sidelines. Now, he's still a part of this youth bloc. He's only 24, but during the last election, he put everything into his support for Howard Dean. 5 years ago, Andy Shapiro was 19 when he was first inspired by the former governor of Vermont.
And today we stand in common purpose to take our country back.
Yeah, and I have a quote with me here that I just dug up from my little personal records, and I can't find the speech it was from, but I was rereading it the other day, and as I was actually speaking to my mom, I was like, this is incredible quote. And it was just, and I still read it today. I'm like, man, why didn't I work a little bit hard to get him elected? But here it is. At every turn, when there has been an imbalance of power, the truth questioned, or our beliefs and values distorted,
the change required to restore our nationhood has always come from the bottom up, from our people.
From our people.
And that's where you felt you were, at the bottom, or
yeah,
part of the people?
Yeah, just part of the people, and that fact that, you know, we're the ones that bring about change, and it hit me on that political level, and it hit me on that personal level that, you know, if change is going to come either in this country politically or change is going to come in my own personal life, mm-hmm, I'm going to have to take the first step. I'm not going to have to wait for somebody else to do it. It's my turn to step up to the plate.
Well, this was also the time of the when the internet became a really powerful political tool. Was that a part of your world as well?
Yeah, I joined Meetup. That was sort of the launch. MoveOn was huge. And then Meetup, the Dean campaign really used it to have little gatherings around the country where he'd do calls and there'd be little Dean parties all over the place. And I was really actively involved in that and go to little houses around Bloomington, Indiana and have these little Dean parties. and the campaign would send DVDs for you to watch before he spoke to you. And it was a great way to meet some more people.
Andy Shapiro wrote to me about his political awakening. He says he was hooked in June, 5 years ago, when Howard Dean announced his candidacy. When Dean spoke, Andy was listening.
You have the power to take our country back, and you have the power to take the White House back in 2004, and that is exactly what we're going to be doing. You have the power. You have the power. You have the power to take this country back. You have the power. Thank you very much.
As corny as it is, and I hate to say it, but that whole line of, you know, just you have the power definitely struck me. And it struck me in a couple of different ways, both in the ability to change the world politically, but also the ability to sort of change yourself. And I know that probably wasn't what he was going for, but I sort of took it that way because at the same time I was hoping to change the world politically. I was getting sort of personal power over my life and sort of who I was and who I was becoming.
Andy Shapiro makes the point that there's always something personal behind the political. He started figuring out who he was in his last year of high school. His parents divorced when he was in ninth grade. He lived with his mother. Andy didn't see much of his dad, even though he lived close by.
So once they got divorced, it was sort of like, well, why should I keep going over here and spending time with this person who really hasn't spent time with me, or at least that was my thinking, you know, for the past, you know, 8 years or so.
When did you finally establish some kind of rapport with your dad?
It was spring of 2002. So right as I was getting ready to graduate high school, he said he was feeling the best he'd felt in years. And at that point, we started hanging out more. I'd go over to his house quite frequently, and it started just, you know, we'd have dinner and watch movies. We'd do the typical get pizza or Chinese food and sort of gorge on all that. Then we'd take turns picking a movie for a week. And so he'd choose a classic usually, and I'd choose some dumb comedy or something like that that a teenage boy is going to like.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Andy Shapiro says there was one specific conversation with his father that really opened up communication between them.
There was one night that sort of kicked it all off where I don't know what set me off, but we got into this huge argument that lasted until 5 in the morning or so, just about finances and my parents' relationship and everything like that. And we were just arguing all night long. And
you asking a lot of questions? Is that what was going on?
I was more accusing than asking questions.
Huh.
I was not in the mood to be asking questions. I was at that point where I knew it all, and I didn't really want to be told anything other than what I thought I knew.
Interesting, though, he didn't bounce you down the front steps of the porch.
He stayed engaged
definitely. On this one.
Exactly, yeah. It might be important to note he was a psychiatrist. So
so he liked to argue.
yeah, definitely. So, you know, that lasted well into the morning, and I remember we just reached this point of just calm where I don't know if we just agreed to disengage or agree to disagree, but everything sort of just cooled down. And at that point, you know, one or the other of us just said, hey, want to get something to eat, and, you know, said, yeah. And I went to the grocery store that's open 24 hours, just drove about a mile down the street, got a ton of donuts and a bunch of milk, and we just sat around early in the morning eating donuts and then just chatting casually, you know, kind of like that huge long hours of arguments had never happened. Or maybe in a way, you know, we were chatting like it had happened because now we were actually talking, kind of like civilized human beings.
Did it change the relationship, that late evening discussion, disagreement, we'll call it whatever?
It definitely did, because at that point, I think, once sort of that barrier had been broken of communication, everything was a bit easier and started talking more and more just about my future and about the world around us and just everything, you know, my thoughts and his thoughts on all these things that were going on in the world. You know, 9/11 was the September before, and maybe it was just I finally got an outlet for a lot of maybe pent-up resentment and aggression that I just needed to get out towards maybe feeling a little left behind in terms of our relationship. Partly that, and partly that, yeah, I was now on sort of an equal playing field with someone who had always been, you know, towering over me in a sense. And I realized I was able to sort of make my voice heard as well.
But it still sounds a little bit, Andy, like he was something of a sounding board for you. Like you could take a measure of how well you were doing by seeing how well you could hold an argument with him.
That is exactly it. That is exactly it.
And how did you do?
I think I did pretty well, personally, but I'm sort of someone who's pretty stubborn with his beliefs. So if I feel like I'm arguing my point, I'm going to usually feel like I'm coming out pretty well. But that might just be by virtue of the fact that I had a sounding board who was willing to let me talk my head off for a while and sort of be very open to listening.
Yeah, how generous was he? I know that arguments in my family rarely end with someone saying, I'm wrong, you're right. There's a kind of acknowledgement. Okay, you've made a good argument.
Yeah, there was definitely never I'm wrong on his part, and there was definitely never I'm wrong on my part. I think most of the time it was him sort of conceding maybe fair point in terms of, okay, you made a good argument, but I'm not going to agree with it. I don't think there are any minds being changed.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Soon after this opening up of communication, Andy Shapiro graduated from high school. 1 month later, his father died.
I remember very vividly the funeral, being really upset at the fact that some of my friends and their family were there, because I didn't invite any of them, and it turns out in the paper, obviously, there were services for James Shapiro will be on this day, you know.
Why didn't you want them there?
I still, to this day, do not know, but it's a feeling I definitely had inside me then, and I remember it vividly when I saw one of my friends walk through the door with his family. I was like, what is this? Why are these people here? And I really just sat there during the services being pretty unemotional.
You didn't speak at the funeral?
You know, I remember going up, on the little stage or whatever it was with my sister. But no, I didn't give any sort of eulogy as far as I can remember. And I feel like I'd remember that.
Yeah. When you think back on that time now, Andy, how do you make sense of it?
It was just like things were starting to open up and go well. And all of a sudden, bam, it was all taken away. And so I feel like it was a lot easier to just forget that the past few months had been happening and go back to this, pre-open communication, pre-kind of better relationship world and just sort of shut it all off. And I don't know if it's bad or not, but I remember one of the first things I said to my mom was when he passed away was I had this trip planned with one of my best friends to go to New York. And the first thing I said to my mom was like, well, can I still go to New York? she was like, of course. And so I sort of had this, weekend-long getaway, maybe a week or so after he passed away, and then came back to Missouri. And a couple weeks after that, I was a freshman in Indiana University, sort of a couple states away and a complete world away from me.
The one thing that Andy Shapiro did take off to college was something he wasn't even aware of at the time. He confronted his father. He had not backed down. He was developing the confidence to speak for himself. And all this was about to take root in a political way. It was right around the time that the first bombs fell on Baghdad at the start of the war in Iraq. And we'll talk about that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. This hour, we're peering over the horizon at what comes next in the race for the White House. There is every reason to believe that Barack Obama will be the candidate for the Democrats. His campaign's receiving a lot of support from younger voters. My guest today is Andy Shapiro. He was a DENIAC in the last primary campaign, one of that gang of young people working for Howard Dean in 2003 and 2004. But Andy didn't always have that kind of confidence. He says through much of high school, he was kind of shy.
I was definitely the quiet one in the class. If I knew an answer, I wouldn't, raise my hand, even though usually I was begging to answer it. I just never would say the answer. I was too afraid even to speak up when I knew something.
Andy says he had a coming-of-age moment when he argued with his father and held his own ground. He got respect. Just a few months later, Andy left home in Missouri and went to school at Indiana University.
We were always labeled the gay hippie dorm by people and stuff like that, but it was sort of the liberal bastion of thought and arts at Indiana, I guess. So that sort of helped me, that I was sort of going to an environment where I knew people would be kind of like me in a way.
And did you take, Andy, some of the confidence that you had built up in those political conversations with your father? Was that still a part of your character at that point?
It was definitely still part of my character. I remember As awful as it is to think about some of the things that I wrote for, the silly little dorm paper, I remember being very assertive about my beliefs in that and, things like that. I was definitely more outspoken.
When did you get a chance to actually take this assertiveness of yours and turn it in a political direction?
It was starting with the Howard Dean campaign, which I quickly became an obsessed, crazed DENIAC or whatever you want to call us. I sort of jumped onto the Dean bandwagon once he started talking about opposition to the war. I was already a pretty avid politico, so I was reading all over, the web about every little potential candidate, and, I was starting to get into the blogs, which were just starting back then. I had been a little John Kerry person. I remember on my little AOL Instant Messenger profile. I had a little John Kerry for president thing all of 2002. But then that quickly switched over to Bean for America. I started talking to people about him, talking to relatives, talking to people at school. And the Students for Dean group started up at Indiana University, and I joined up in that, and there's a little quote in the Indiana Daily Student for me, and that's when I definitely picked up hardcore with my political beliefs and assertiveness in that realm.
Around the time that the war in Iraq started, that was when Andy Shapiro and other young people got wrapped up in the Dean campaign.
I got so caught up that I almost dropped out of school and moved to Burlington, Vermont.
Seriously?
I still remember the spring of 2003, I was looking at apartments in Burlington, and I was really contemplating leaving school. Obviously, dropping out is probably not the best word, because I would have suspended my education, I guess is a better way to put it. But I was looking towards moving up to Vermont and working on the campaign there, either in a paid or volunteer position. And I was in active communication pretty much daily with a few people up there. But I was still not quite there to sort of take that leap. I still wasn't feeling secure enough, I suppose, in my decisions. And I felt, no, I have to stay here in school, and I have to go home and see my mom this summer and see my friends. So I sort of missed that opportunity.
Do you regret that now, Andy?
Oh, God. in lists of regrets, that's top three. Huh. Probably number two on my list. It's one of those things that I look back, and anytime I read stuff from people that were, you know, just right in the middle of the Dean storm up in Burlington, I'm always like, oh, man, I should have gone up there.
But Andy Shapiro still made a commitment. He left school and made the drive from Indiana to Iowa.
I was in a car with one of my friends, and we completely took the wrong route. We got lost beyond all belief to Iowa from Indiana, and I remember stopping at a truck stop, and an old couple told us how to get sort of back on the way. We were going to Davenport, and all of a sudden, there are these caravans of just cars with Dean stickers and Dean posters and Dean billboards and everything, and people waving at every other car and honking, and it was just this convoy of people from all over the country coming from the East Coast and coming from Ohio and everywhere, flooding in, and everybody was our age, and it was an incredible sight.
Did you have posters or stickers on your car? Did they recognize you as a part of this?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I still have my Dean for America sticker on my car today. So, but, yeah, they definitely knew we were with them, and everybody was honking, and it was great. And once we got to our cabin that we were staying in, one of the cars we passed with the people in it, they were in the cabin that we were staying in. I was like, oh, I recognize these guys. We passed them out on I-80.
It's interesting, though. I mean, that would be a real feeling of being a part of something, I would imagine.
Definitely. I think it was probably the strongest communal group I've ever been a part of, even if lots of those relationships that formed weren't that deep, and I don't really keep in touch with those people all that much anymore. It was still one of the strongest communal bonds I have ever had in my life.
My recollection is the campaign in Iowa didn't go that well.
As I remember, I think.
You'd remember that.
Yeah, it did not go too well. I still remember going door to door about a day or so before the caucuses, and it was kind of amazing when we'd speak to people at their doors. Everybody was like, oh, I'm for Kerry. Not for Gebhardt, not for Dean, not for Edwards. Everybody was for Kerry. And so that was when I think a few of us started getting the idea that, you know, oh, you know, the Dean campaign probably knew it all, but to us on the ground, we were like, oh, uh-oh.
There have been people who said since then, Andy, that all the young Deaniacs in Iowa may not in fact have done Howard Dean any favors, that people who lived there, longtime Iowans, felt a little bit invaded by guys like you. Do you think there's any truth to that?
I think there's definitely truth to that. I still remember going to one of the rallies with Dean, and we all got these little orange hats that said the Iowa Perfect Storm. It had like a little hurricane-type icon on it or something, and you know, we wore them everywhere we went, so you just see swarms of kids with these orange hats. And I remember at this rally, they told us to take them off. So it was, you know, so it didn't look like, oh, there's all the out-of-town kids, you know, at this rally. I remember that very vividly. So, yeah, I'm sure it did not help.
Did you ever meet Howard Dean?
You know, I was in the front row for a couple speeches and rallies, you know, shook his hand, but I didn't really get a chance to talk to him. The candidate I actually got a chance to talk to at length for a few times was actually John Edwards. And there's, you know, I'm sure somewhere back in the C-SPAN archives, there's video of me just speaking to John Edwards, decked out in Dean gear, no less.
Just to be clear, this was in 2004.
Yeah, this was in 2004, yeah.
Where were you the night of the caucus?
we were seeing how things were going, and we started to head home, turned around and headed towards Indiana and listened on the radio. Sort of depressing route home.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Andy Shapiro is my guest. He's recalling what it was like to be a part of the young people who were the backbone of the Dean for America campaign back in 2003 and 04. Andy was still listening to the radio when he heard Howard Dean's fateful speech at the end of the Iowa caucuses.
Not only are we going to New Hampshire, Tom Harkin, we're going to South Carolina and Oklahoma and Arizona and North Dakota and New Mexico. We're going to California and Texas and New York. And we're going to South Dakota and Oregon and Washington and Michigan. And then we're going to Washington, D.C. to take back the White House.
Yeah! I'm still feisty about that to this day because, you know, people in the audience really couldn't even hear him scream that much. And all the networks used the mic in front of him that was going straight to the network feeds and sort of heightened the loudness and the craziness of it. And I don't know if it's just a conspiracy on us Dean people that are saying that, maybe, but... I really hate to ever blame the media for anything. I think that's a little silly thing. But, you know, if you can frame somebody being a little bit nuts, a little bit crazy, yeah, that can help sort of bring somebody down.
The reason I'm asking, Andy, is I just wonder what happened to your sort of passion for Dean after Iowa. Did you go on to other states? Did you continue to work for him? Or did you begin to disconnect yourself?
I tried to stay active for, you know, another month or so with the students for Dean and Dean for America. But once it became clear sort of what was happening and, you know, Kerry consolidated everything pretty much immediately, I disengaged in politics for a long time. For a couple years, I voted in the election, but I did nothing for Kerry. I was just too disillusioned, completely disillusioned.
Like a plague on all of you? Was that your attitude?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, you took away this, you know, this was going to be perfect. This was going to be great. Now it's gone. And I'm not going to, you know, I don't believe in the system anymore. So I sort of completely detached myself from that. I still followed everything very actively, but I was not active myself.
It's interesting listening to you say that because I know that there are a lot of people at this particular point who are passionate for Obama and a whole bunch of other people who are passionate for Clinton. And you know, there's this speculation that gets talked about a lot these days that one or the other group of people is just going to do exactly the same thing, say, well, you didn't choose my guy, you didn't choose our woman, we're gone. Do you see that happening as well?
Potentially, and you know, I'm scared about it, and I feel like a lot of the younger people supporting Obama have a much more likely chance to sit this one out, maybe, if it comes to it, and if he's not the nominee. But I really hope that doesn't reach that point, and they'll come to their senses and get to the voting booth, much like I did. Even if they're not actively supporting the nominee, they'll at least vote come November.
Andy Shapiro says he's not entirely sure why, but he's not that engaged in this year's campaign.
At this point, not really. It's kind of terrible. I'm at this point, I don't have a dog in this fight. I'll vote for the Democratic nominee. You know, my guy didn't win this round. I was an Edwards guy. But half the people I meet are genuinely, you know, really interested and really involved, and the other half are probably like I was, where, you know, if the bottom drops out, they're gone. But I think that's how it's always going to be. We can always be idealistic about everybody's going to be involved and everybody will stick with it till the end and fight for everything. But, you know, that's not realistic and you have to be a little bit practical about things, even if it's no fun.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Andy Shapiro looks back now at what drew him into politics in the first place. And he says it has a lot to do with his father. The two of them had grown apart, but then developed a rapport when Andy was in his last year in high school.
All the discussions with my dad definitely helped me sort of solidify where I was at politically and where I stood on a lot of things. To be honest, Obama, he doesn't drive me nuts, but when I see him drawing those crowds, I get very excited because I see in him a person that's able to get so many more people invested in politics, and the more people there are involved, the greater amount of change there will be.
Do you think about all the youngsters in that crowd going through that same kind of disillusion that you did. I'm not suggesting that Obama won't become the candidate or won't become the president, but, I mean, how tenuous is that kind of support and passion? You've seen it from the previous campaign.
Yeah. Well, I don't think the support of him is tenuous at all. I think everybody's really solidly gung-ho behind him, but I definitely feel like maybe something happens that he's not the nominee or not, you know, and he doesn't become president, that, yeah, maybe people might get disillusioned like I did, but I hope people are a little bit smarter than me now. and they recognize that even if your guy doesn't win or your girl doesn't win, that you should stick it out and stick out for what you believe in and fight for it one way or the other.
Is there a little part of you, though, that is hooked, that will always remain connected to politics in some way?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm on the L in Chicago, and I'm reading blogs on my phone. You know, I'm any chance I have, I'm listening to political coverage. I will never let go of this if it's, you know, a down year in politics. I will always find something to latch on to, even if it's a little house race in Nebraska. I'm never going to lose this.
Why? Why do you care so much?
It's absolutely fascinating to me how people choose leaders and how leaders act in office and, you know, the good and the bad that comes out of our entire sort of crazy process here in the country.
It's funny because a lot of people look at what you've just called the crazy process and say, I want nothing to do with it.
No, that's exactly right. But, you know, I guess maybe if there weren't obsessive compulsive political freaks like me, the country wouldn't run. I don't know. Or maybe it would actually be better off. I'm not sure.
Andy Shapiro is not done with politics. One thing is clear. He starts a new job this week doing research for candidates for the U.S. House of Representatives. Andy joined me from a studio in Chicago. Special thanks today to our friends at Vermont Public Radio who helped out with the Howard Dean audio for today's story. We're always on the lookout for your personal political stories. As we get closer to summer conventions and autumn campaigning, we're going to be hearing a lot from the pundits and from the candidates, but we'd like to hear about your own sense of politics. I had a recent conversation with Phyllis Barnwell. She's been an activist for women's rights and for racial equality for the past 60 years. This year, she had to choose between Clinton and Obama, and she saw it through her own memory.
You didn't ask me what the subject of my speech was in 1949.
This was your
high school public speaking contest that I won.
Do you remember the title of the speech?
Absolutely. A Woman for President.
Did people take you seriously?
They thought that was the silliest subject going.
You realize that in 1949, if you'd written the other side of the current Democratic dilemma, you'd have been writing not an African-American for president, not a black for president, but a Negro for president.
That's right.
And what would people have thought? Would they have thought that just as absurd?
I would never have ended up in the finals of that public speaking contest.
See, the personal is political. If you have a story about the first time you voted or a moment of political awakening, get in touch with me through our website at thestory.org or call and leave me a message on our telephone line at 1-888-966-9862. You know, yesterday on the program, I talked with Dennis Golay and Larry Gibson. The two tested positive for HIV back in 1987, a time when that news was regarded as a death sentence. However, they started on some of the early experimental drugs, and they are still alive and still together, while those antiretrovirals have prolonged their lives. Dennis and Larry have also aged faster than other men their age.
For us to still be an original couple with HIV is nothing short of amazing to both of us.
That is definitely a curiosity, yeah.
You can see it in our faces and stuff. Our faces are drawn and sort of skeletal, you know, from the drugs. They do that.
It has affected our appearances, most definitely, but it hasn't affected our smiles. They're still the same, and they still mean the same. And, you know, and that twinkling in the eyes that we've always had with each other and for each other, that's still the same. That hasn't ever changed. Maybe it's brighter now than it's ever been, really.
After I talked with Dennis and Larry, I got a note from Jeannie in Los Angeles. She wrote to say, wow, I just finished hearing the story. Their extraordinary humanity, she wrote, and their beauty came through the radio. I'm blown away and edified. From Chapel Hill, North Carolina, Paul wrote to say, I just finished listening to your story about the men living with HIV/AIDS. I live with my partner of 17 years, and we both have HIV. We will both be celebrating our 60th birthdays with a party next month. Needless to say, I hung on every word. My partner's face is ravaged with the same muscle loss, and I was intrigued with one of the men's treatment to fill in his face. Thanks so much for your stories. I listen daily, and so many of those stories have touched my life in ways you can't even imagine. And so if you have a story to suggest, once again, the website is thestory.org. You'll find a couple of quick and easy buttons to push there, so you can send me just a couple of lines about the story you'd like to talk about. Or you can call on our telephone line and leave me a short message. It's 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Air travel continues to make the news for all the wrong reasons. Flights get canceled or delayed, bags are lost, or now it costs money to check them. There's a new survey out that says people are increasingly reluctant to fly, and that's costing the economy $26 billion. Well, I've talked with people who've experienced some extraordinary hassles with flying. One man was hauled off a flight for being a suspected terrorist. Another man arrested at the airport in a case of mistaken identity. Today, though, I have an air travel story that's somewhat on the lighter side. Phil Dumas wrote to me about a time when he was in Seattle on business. Now, he lives in Deland, Florida, and had promised his kids that he would be home for the weekend.
I got to the airport. I want to say I was in the terminal by about 6:30, mainly because it was one of the airlines that doesn't allow you to do the checking in online the night before. So I had got myself a large coffee because after 4 days of pretty much only sleeping 4 or 5 hours a night, I really needed a large coffee.
And you take your coffee seriously, do you?
Oh, I do take my coffee seriously. I only have one cup. This is my rule. I just don't say what size cup it is.
Okay, well, tell me. How big is it?
Mammoth. It's about 32 ounces. So it's
that's 4 cups
my
of
one
coffee.
Cup of coffee. Again, it's one cup of coffee, and that's what I tell my doctor.
Okay.
So I carry my coffee back over to the gate there, and I'm waiting, and the lady comes up. And by the time I get back over, the attendant for the gate was there, and I was about 10th in line. So a little line had started queuing up, and I hurried myself back over with my bags. And I stood there for probably about 10 minutes, maybe 15. And she finally opened and started taking the first people. And that was when it kind of struck me that, you know, I was 2/3 of the way through this coffee, and I was thinking, you know, I should just step out of line and go use the restroom. And at that point, I turned around and looked behind me, and there was at least 80 people behind me. And I thought, well, no, I'm not losing the spot. I'll get stuck in the middle someplace. I didn't want to miss this flight because missing a flight 7:15 in Seattle when it's actually, you know, 11:15 on the East Coast where I'm going back to means that I'm not going to get home on Friday night like I tell my kids that I will.
How quickly is the line moving?
It's not. Not quickly enough, I can assure you. So as I stand there and realize that, you know, and I still can't stop myself from drinking the coffee either because it's just, you know, complete reflex. And I finally stop myself when there's maybe 4 or 5 ounces left in the cup. And I look down and I went, yeah, that's just a bad idea. This is not good. And I looked up and now I'm probably the 6th person in line. And it's creeping. 5th, 4th. And by the time I was the 3rd or 2nd person in line, it was just becoming to the point where I was thinking I was going to have to make a decision shortly. And I thought about, you know what, and it was the gate right next to the bathroom. So as I glance over my right shoulder, I can literally see the sign for the bathroom. And I'm thinking, I'm going to have to ask the lady behind me, just hold my spot in line or something. It won't take me 30 seconds. Can run over, I can do what I need to, I can be back. And I turned around and the woman standing behind me in line looked like she needed the coffee that I had. She had probably the most dour look on her face, almost like a permanent scowl. And it was enough to completely cut off the idea of asking her to hold my spot in line. And I thought to myself, gosh, okay, what if I just leave my stuff here? And I turned back over, and sure enough, there was the sign that says, you know, report all suspicious bags.
Yeah, unattended luggage, you know, will be blown
nothing
up.
Nothing unattended. That's the one.
So at this point, you're getting close to the line, but you're pinching your thighs together.
Yes, absolutely. I had started shifting weight left and right, starting, yes, to kind of, you know, see how close I could squeeze my knees together. And
I have this image of a sort of four-year-old boy doing this thing because Kids at that age, they don't have any shame, right? Hands in the front pockets.
That's it. That's exactly. Well, yeah, I can shamelessly say that that's exactly what was going on. You know, I was thinking, okay, anything to make this better right now because this is just pure misery. And I was second in line, and I was to the point where it was critical, period, end of story. I was going to have to make a decision shortly. I had noticed over in the corner there was an artificial tree that was closer than the bathroom. And I found myself going to a place that you never would think as a human being in our society ever go to. I was going to either use that tree and hope for the best, or I was going to make it to the bathroom, one or the other. And right when I find myself, you know, doing this battle of consciousness, you know, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? She says, next, please. And lo and behold, it's my turn. And I step up to the counter, and I am squirming and fidgeting like you would not believe. And the woman looked at me. She goes, are you okay? And I said, no, got a little PPD going on here. I just I'll be okay. Let me just get checked
in. Wait a minute, a little what?
PPD. That's short for pee-pee dance. We have four children, and anybody who's raised children knows when your child starts doing the pee-pee dance. That's the left foot, right foot, squirm, squirm, squirm.
Okay.
And I didn't want to say the words pee-pee dance in front of her, number one, because, you know, it's a little embarrassing. So I said, you know, just a little PPD going on here. And, you know, as soon as we get checked in, I'll be fine. I'm just going to run to the restroom.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Phil Dumas was flying from the West Coast to his home in Florida, and as he was just telling me, the ticket attendant was wondering why Phil was squirming as he was checking in. He explained that he was doing what he called the pee-pee dance, or PPD for short. Well, she was surprisingly sympathetic. Here's what she said.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, I'm so sorry. Here, let me get you in. Let me get you checked in. Here, just give me your ID. And she went through the questions. She goes, you are so brave. My brother suffers from PPD. And I looked at her. By now, nothing is registered with me. I'm just looking at her like, okay, so you've got a four-year-old brother? Okay. And I'm looking at her. I'm going, wow, she looked a little old to have a younger brother like
that. Tell the truth, Phil. At this point, you're not being very rational. You're looking forward to getting to the bathroom.
Absolutely. You know what? She could have told me, okay, you're going to hold on to the tail of the plane to Denver. And I would have gone, great, give me the ticket. That would have been the end of it. She would have said, we're charging you $900 more. I'd have handed her the credit card.
All right. Now put me out of my misery. You did make it to the bathroom, didn't you?
I did. Oh, you know, the three greatest moments in my life, marrying my wife, seeing my children born, and making it to the bathroom that day. So, yes, I made it. And, you know, when I came out, I was a new man. I was walking on sunshine. It was great. I just was, you know, almost a terrible mishap there that would have just ruined the whole day, period. I mean, there's really no way to recover from that, right? I mean, your luggage is checked, and you can go, what? If you do wet yourself, you have to clean out your pants and then get on the plane anyway in front of, you know, 90 complete strangers. That's not embarrassing.
And sit beside one of them.
No, this was the greatest part. When I got on, the lady was there, and she had this huge smile for me, and she took my ticket. She was the ticket taker, the attendant there, and she goes, hey, yeah, you have a great flight. There's somebody's going to meet you on the other side and get you to your gate, and thank you so much for flying with us. And I thought, wow, okay, thank you. I'm thinking, somebody's going to meet me. She must think that that's my terminus. I made sure, you know, I got on and I looked down and I had both my tickets for my flight to Denver and then Denver to Orlando. So that wasn't quite the case, but, you know, you don't really want to question somebody in authority that can have you dragged off in handcuffs very much. So I just kind of
nod and smile and just keep on moving.
Precisely. So I just smiled and nodded and, you know, ushered my way down the little walkway there and got onto the plane. And it was a pretty full flight. And I was, first of all, happy that I stayed in line and got the seat that I did, because it turned out that I had the whole row to myself.
Three seats to yourself? Yeah.
3 seats to myself. Absolutely. And I thought, wow. And I looked around, and sure enough, you know, they had the middle seats full in front of me and behind me. And there I was by myself. And I thought, man, this is really my morning. Today is actually turning up for me. So I stretched out and relaxed a little bit and read a book on the way to Denver. Great flight. Wonderful flight. And getting to Denver, got there, landed. Everything was great. And when I walked off the plane, there was a woman there who knew me. She wasn't holding up a sign. She didn't have a picture, but she said, "Are you Phil Dumont?" I said, "Well, yes, I am." She goes, "Hi, I'm so-and-so, and I'm here to make sure that you get to your next flight." Okay. Thinking to myself, wow, this is interesting. And then I thought, you know, man, that lady back there that gave me my tickets, she must have really felt a kinship with me. That's great. Gosh, you know.
Now you're a preferred elite customer for some reason.
Yes, but absolutely. That's exactly what it was. You know, I'm thinking to myself, now this is air travel. You know, forget having to run between these terminals. I got on the little golf cart, catered over there. Would you like something to eat or drink on the way over? No, I'm fine. Thank you. Get over to the gate. And she personally went behind with the attendant. She goes, "Just stand right there for a second." She goes behind with the attendant and speaks to the attendant for a moment, and she checks me in.
There isn't a little part of you, Phil, that's going, what's really going on here?
You know, here's the problem. You start buying into it. It's like, wow, this is VIP treatment. I'm okay with it.
I am important. I always knew it, and they've just figured it out.
You really don't want it to stop. You don't.
Okay.
You know, and the last thing you want to do is call attention to someone and go, "I don't know who you think I am, but I'm not that person. Because, you know, I'm just a normal guy flying home."
Yeah, right.
And she came over. She goes, "Okay, we've got you squared away. Hang on a second. We're going to get you on the plane." And I was like, "Okay, that's great. Thank you." They had the first class boarding call, and she waves me over, hands me my ticket. "There you are. Have a good trip." And I looked down, and I had been upgraded to first class, first row first class. And I go, "Thank you so very much." She goes, "You have such a great flight, and make sure that you fly us again." And I said, "Oh, absolutely, no doubt." And I'm thinking to myself, man, this is a great airline. I'm going to call people and tell them how good this airline is.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Phil Dumas' trip didn't end there. He still had to get from Denver to his home in Florida. Of course, being upgraded to first class didn't hurt. But his journey became even stranger.
I was in the front row. As a matter of fact, I was on the aisle in the front row. Actually, I was switching back and forth, to be honest with you, because I could, because there was nobody next to me again. And I scoot over to the first seat and look out the window, scoot back to the aisle. And there was only one other person in the entire row, and that gentleman was sitting on the aisle right next to me to my right. So I tend to notice things about people. You know, the shoes, the fingernails, the haircut, things like that. And I looked over and I thought to myself, you know, he's not carrying a laptop bag. He's reading 2 newspapers and 3 magazines. And, okay, that's interesting. Sat down and we got into the air. And I was going to speak to him. And when I would look over, it was almost like he would bury his face further into the newspaper he was reading or further into the magazine. And I was thinking to myself, well, that's quite odd. You know, I just wanted to have a little bit of cheerful banter, but some people don't travel well with others, and that's fine. So I'll just sit right here, and I'll be just fine, too. And as I started reading my own, I realized that he was looking at me out of the corner of his eye. So when I looked up, sure enough, here we are back to this cat and mouse game. He buries his head back in the magazine. I'm going, what on earth? And so now all kinds of things are going through my head, like, what is this guy staring at me for? You know, does he like me? Let's see. I got my ring on, so I'm married. Okay, I'm good there. And I look back over, and he buries his head back into the same magazine. And this is the third time I've seen him read the magazine, by the way.
And, so, and this flight, Denver to Orlando, it's what, 2.5, 3 hours?
It's actually 3.5 hours, yeah.
Okay.
It's a pretty long flight.
That's a lot of cat and mouse, yeah.
Oh, it is a lot of cat and mouse, absolutely. And the only time that I saw him stop and actually look at me, I got up to use the restroom right there in the front. And as soon as I stood up, he froze and stared at me. And I was like, oh, okay. I went into the restroom and did what I needed to. When I came out, he hadn't moved a micrometer. He was still just stock still staring at me as I came out. And I kind of looked at him, and he looked down and then looked right straight back up at me. I thought, oh, Okay, so I kind of nodded his way. Absolutely no response. Nothing. Just stone-faced. I sat back down, and he went back to reading his book. And that was the extent of our interaction. And I get to Orlando, and there's no one there to meet me, which was kind of disappointing after Denver.
Balloons, confetti, something. You
know. Something. Take me to my car, you know, give me free parking.
Yeah.
But no one there to meet me, and I hopped in the car, and sure enough, I made it home and was able to see the kids just before they went to bed and put the last ones to bed. And my wife asked, you know, the perfunctory question that all wives ask, how was your flight? And I said, well, it started out kind of rough, and I thought I was going to have a problem, but it turned out to be the greatest flight. Do you know I got upgraded on the way home? She goes, you did? How did you get upgraded? I said, I have no idea. And I said, gosh, you know what? It almost was a nightmare this morning, though. And she goes, well, why is that? And I said, because I had drank my entire cup of coffee. She goes, your one cup of coffee? I said, exactly.
She knows how and big your cups are.
Yes, she knows. And she says, okay. And I said, and I thought I was going to have an accident standing there waiting for the lady to get me my ticket. And it was horrible because I was the 10th person in line. And I was squirming and moving like you wouldn't believe. And I just had to go so bad. And I thought I was going to have an accident there. And she starts giggling. And she goes, I bet you looked funny doing that. I go, well, when I got up there, the lady asked me about her. And I told her, no, I'm just doing the PPD dance. I said, no, actually, I told her, no, it's just a little PPD. You know, as soon as I go to the bathroom, I'll be fine. And my wife, just frozen, she looked at me. She goes, think carefully. Did you say the words PP dance or did you say PPD? And I go, oh, no, I said PPD. Yeah, because I wasn't sure how she would take it. You know, it was like 6:45 in the morning. You're joking. My wife just starts slowly shaking her head. And I go, what? She goes, hun, in psychological circles, PPD stands for paranoid personality disorder. You've just admitted to these people that you have a mental illness that you're flying with. And I said, what?
And that's why they were with you so carefully and so politely?
That was it. All the way through. And all of a sudden, it finally made sense. You know, the reason why they made sure I got to the plane and why the row was all for myself and why she was so nice. And when she was relating to me how I was so brave and her brother had PPD, because as soon as my wife said that, the whole conversation came back to me and it was like, oh, gosh, now it makes sense.
And the guy on the airplane was there to watch you probably.
I'm about 95% sure that the gentleman on the airplane was probably a sky marshal.
Phil, have you flown since that day?
Not on that airline.
I'm wondering if your name is red flagged now on that airline.
I don't think so. Well, on that airline, I do not know, and I have not flown on it. I'm just hoping that they get bought sooner or later so I can go back on it. But every time I go to check in, I'm just waiting for somebody to look up at me and kind of nod.
Or smile.
And then I'll know. Or smile and say, how are you feeling today?
Have you changed your coffee drinking habits at all?
No, not much. No.
So this could happen again, is what you're telling me.
No, because we do learn from our mistakes. Trust me, I'm not doing this again. I haven't had to go back to Seattle, thank goodness, and I hope I never do. Because if I did run into one, I'm sure I would probably just die of embarrassment. Hi, you might remember me. I'm cured now. And probably the worst footnote to this entire thing is I've actually got a bachelor's in industrial psychology.
So you should have known.
Of all people, I should have known.
Phil Dumas lives in Deland, Florida. He used our website as a place to send me his story. You can do exactly the same thing if you have a tale that you were willing to share with us here on the program. I'd love to hear about it. The website is thestory.org. And if you want to think about it, take your time, write me a letter. The Story, 120 Friday Center Drive. This is our address. Write this down. The Story, 120 Friday Center Drive, Chapel Hill, North Carolina. The zip code is 27517. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
This story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.